of your cult of zero worship. This symbol of impotence, the congenital dependent, is your image of man and your standard of value, in whose likeness you strive to refashion your soul. It's only human, you cry in defense of any depravity, reaching the stage of self-abasement where you seek to make the concept human mean the weakling, the fool, the rotter, the liar, the failure, the coward, the fraud, and to exile from the human race the hero, the thinker, the producer, the inventor, the strong, the purposeful, the pure. As if to feel were human, but to think were not. As if to fail were human, but to succeed were not. As if corruption were human, but virtue were not. As if the premise of death were proper to man, but the premise of life were not. In order to deprive us of honor, that you may then deprive us of our wealth, you have always regarded us as slaves who deserve no moral recognition. You praise any venture that claims to be non-profit, and damn the men who made the profits that make the venture possible. You regard as in the public interest any project serving those who do not pay. It is not in the public interest to provide any services for those who do the paying. Public benefit is anything given as alms. To engage in trade is to injure the public. Public welfare is the welfare of those who do not earn it. Those who do are entitled to no welfare. The public to you is whoever has failed to achieve any virtue or value, whoever achieves it, whoever provides the goods you require for survival, ceases to be regarded as part of the public, or as part of the human race. What blank out permitted you to hope that you could get away with this muck of contradictions, and to plan it as an ideal society, when the no of your victims was sufficient to demolish the whole of your structure? What permits any insolent beggar to wave his sores in the face of his betters, and to plead for help in the tone of a threat? You cry, as he does, that you are counting on our pity. But your secret hope is the moral code that has taught you to count on our guilt. You expect us to feel guilty of our virtues in the presence of your vices, wounds, and failures. Guilty of succeeding at existence, guilty of enjoying the life that you damn, yet beg us to help you to live. Do you want to know who is John Galt? I am the first man of ability who refused to regard it as guilt. I am the first man who would not do penance for my virtues, or let them be used as the tools of my destruction. I am the first man who would not suffer martyrdom at the hands of those who wished me to perish for the privilege of keeping them alive. I am the first man who told them that I did not need them, and until they learned to deal with me as traitors, giving value for value, they would have to exist without me as I would exist without them. Then I would let them learn whose is the need and whose the ability. And if human survival is the standard, whose terms would set the way to survive? I have done by plan and intention what had been done throughout history by silent default. There have always been men of intelligence who went on strike in protest and despair, but they did not know the meaning of their action. The man who retires from public life to think, but not to share his thoughts, the man who chooses to spend his years in the obscurity of menial employment, keeping to himself the fire of his mind, never giving it form, expression, or reality, refusing to bring it into a world he despises, the man who is defeated by revulsion, the man who renounces before he has started, the man who gives up rather than give in, the man who functions at a fraction of his capacity, disarmed by his longing for an ideal he has not found, they are on strike against unreason, on strike against your world and your values. But not knowing any values of their own, they abandon the quest to know. In the darkness of their hopeless indignation, which is righteous without knowledge of the right, and passionate without knowledge of desire, they concede to you the power of reality and surrender the incentives of their mind, and they perish in bitter futility, as rebels who never learn the object of their rebellion, as lovers who never discovered their love. The infamous times you call the Dark Ages were an era of intelligence on strike, when men of ability went underground and lived undiscovered, studying in secret, and died destroying the works of their mind, when only a few of the bravest of martyrs remained to keep the human race alive. Every period ruled by mystics was an era of stagnation and want, when most men were on strike against existence, working for less than their barest survival, leaving nothing but scraps for their rulers to loot, refusing to think, to venture, to produce, when the ultimate collector of their profits and the final authority on truth or error was the whim of some gilded degenerate sanctioned as superior to reason by divine right and by grace of a club. The road of human history was a string of blank outs over sterile stretches eroded by faith and force, with only a few brief bursts of sunlight, when the released energy of the men of the mind performed the wonders you gaped at, admired, and promptly extinguished again. But there will be no extinction this time. The game of the mystics is up. You will perish, in and by your own unreality. We, the men of reason, will survive. I have called out on strike the kind of martyrs who had never deserted you before. I have given them the weapon they had lacked, the knowledge of their own moral value. I have taught them that the world is ours, whenever we choose to claim it, by virtue and grace of the fact that ours is the morality of life. They, the great victims who had produced all the wonders of humanity's brief summer, they, the industrialists, the conquerors of matter, had not discovered the nature of their right. They had known that theirs was the power. I taught them that theirs was the glory. You who dare to regard us as the moral inferiors of any mystic who claims supernatural visions, you who scramble like a vultures for plundered pennies, yet honor a fortune-teller above a fortune-maker, you who scorn a businessman as ignoble but esteem any posturing artist as exalted, the root of your standards is that mystic miasma which comes from primordial swamps, that cult of death, which pronounces a businessman immoral by reason of the fact that he keeps you alive. You who claim that you long to rise above the crude concerns of the body, above the drudgery of serving mere physical needs. Who is enslaved by physical needs? The Hindu, who labors from sunrise to sunset at the shafts of a hand plow for a bowl of rice? Or the American who is driving a tractor? Who is the conqueror of physical reality? The man who sleeps on a bed of nails? Or the man who sleeps on an inner spring mattress? Which is the monument to the triumph of the human spirit over matter, the germ-eaten hovels on the shorelines of the Ganges, or the Atlantic skyline of New York? Unless you learn the answers to these questions, and learn to stand at reverent attention when you face the achievements of man's mind, you will not stay much longer on this earth, which we love and will not permit you to damn. You will not sneak by with the rest of your lifespan. I have foreshortened the usual course of history, and have let you discover the nature of the payment you had hoped to switch to the shoulders of others. It is the last of your own living power that will now be drained to provide the unearned for the worshippers and carriers of death. Do not pretend that a malevolent reality defeated you. You were defeated by your own evasions. Do not pretend that you will perish for a noble ideal. You will perish as fodder for the haters of man. But to those of you who still retain a remnant of the dignity and will to love one's life, I am offering the chance to make a choice. Choose whether you wish to perish for a morality you have never believed or practiced. Pause on the brink of self-destruction and examine your values and your life. You had known how to take an inventory of your wealth. Now take an inventory of your mind. Since childhood, you have been hiding the guilty secret that you feel no desire to be moral, no desire to seek self-immolation, that you dread and hate your code but dare not say it even to yourself, that you're devoid of those moral instincts which others profess to feel. The less you felt, the louder you proclaimed your selfless love and servitude to others, in dread of ever letting them discover your own self, the self that you betrayed, the self that you kept in concealment like a skeleton in the closet of your body. And they who were at once your dupes and your deceivers, they listened and voiced their loud approval in dread of ever letting you discover that they were harboring the same unspoken secret. Existence among you is a giant pretense, an act you all perform for one another, each feeling that he is the only guilty freak, each placing his moral authority in the unknowable known only to others, each faking the reality he feels they expect him to fake, none having the courage to break the vicious circle. No matter what dishonorable compromise you've made with your impracticable creed, no matter what miserable balance, half cynicism, half superstition, you now manage to maintain, you still preserve the root, the lethal tenet, the belief that the moral and the practical are opposites. Since childhood, you have been running from the terror of a choice you have never dared fully to identify. If the practical, whatever you must practice to exist, whatever works, succeeds, achieves your purpose, whatever brings you food and joy, whatever profits you, is evil. And if the good, the moral, is the impractical, whatever fails, destroys, frustrates, whatever injures you and brings you loss or pain, then your choice is to be moral or to live. The sole result of that murderous doctrine was to remove morality from life. You grew up to believe that moral laws bear no relation to the job of living, except as an impediment and threat, that man's existence is an amoral jungle where anything goes and anything works. And in that fog of switching definitions which descends upon a frozen mind, you have forgotten that the evils damned by your creed were the virtues required for living. And you have come to believe that actual evils are the practical means of existence. Forgetting that the impractical good was self-sacrifice, you believe that self-esteem is impractical. Forgetting that the practical evil was production, you believe that robbery is practical. Swinging like a helpless branch in the wind of an uncharted moral wilderness, you dare not fully to be evil or fully to live. When you are honest, you feel the resentment of a sucker. When you cheat, you feel terror and shame. When you are happy, your joy is diluted by guilt. When you suffer, your pain is augmented by the feeling that pain is your natural state. You pity the men you admire. You believe they are doomed to fail. You envy the men you hate. You believe they are the masters of existence. You feel disarmed when you come up against a scoundrel. You believe that evil is bound to win, since the moral is the impotent, the impractical. Morality, to you, is a phantom scarecrow made of duty, of boredom, of punishment, of pain, a crossbreed between the first schoolteacher of your past and the tax collector of your present, a scarecrow standing in a barren field waving a stick to chase away your pleasures. And pleasure to you is a liquor-soggy brain, a mindless slut, the stupor of a moron who stakes his cash on some animal's race. Since pleasure cannot be moral, if you identify your actual belief, you will find a triple damnation of yourself, of life, of virtue, in the grotesque conclusion you have reached. You believe that morality is a necessary evil. Do you wonder why you live without dignity, love without fire, and die without resistance? Do you wonder why, wherever you look, you see nothing but unanswerable questions, why your life is torn by impossible conflicts, why you spend it straddling irrational fences to evade artificial choices, such as soul or body, mind or heart, security or freedom, private profit or public good? Do you cry that you find no answers? By what means did you hope to find them? You reject your tool of perception, your mind, then complain that the universe is a mystery. You discard your key, then wail that all doors are locked against you. You start out in pursuit of the irrational, then damn existence for making no sense. The fence you have been straddling for 2 hours while hearing my words and seeking to escape them is the coward's formula contained in the sentence, "But we don't have to go to extremes." The extreme you have always struggled to avoid is the recognition that reality is final, that A is A, and that the truth is true. A moral code impossible to practice, a code that demands imperfection or death, has taught you to dissolve all ideas in fog, to permit no firm definitions, to regard any concept as approximate, and any rule of conduct as elastic, to hedge on any principle, to compromise on any value, to take the middle of any road. By extorting your acceptance of supernatural absolutes, it has forced you to reject the absolute of nature. By making moral judgments impossible, it has made you incapable of rational judgment. A code that forbids you to cast the first stone has forbidden you to admit the identity of stones, and to know when or if you're being stoned. The man who refuses to judge, who neither agrees nor disagrees, who declares that there are no absolutes and believes that he escapes responsibility, is the man responsible for all the blood that is now spilled in the world. Reality is an absolute. Existence is an absolute. A speck of dust is an absolute, and so is a human life. Whether you live or die is an absolute. Whether you have a piece of bread or not is an absolute. Whether you eat your bread or see it vanish into a looter's stomach is an absolute. There are two sides to every issue. One side is right and the other is wrong. But the middle is always evil. The man who is wrong still retains some respect for truth, if only by accepting the responsibility of choice. But the man in the middle is the knave, who blanks out the truth in order to pretend that no choice or values exists, who is willing to sit out the course of any battle, willing to cash in on the blood of the innocent or to crawl on his belly to the guilty, who dispenses justice by condemning both the robber and the robbed to jail, who solves conflicts by ordering the thinker and the fool to meet each other halfway. In any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit. In that transfusion of blood which drains the good to feed the evil, the compromiser is the transmitting rubber tube. You, who are half rational, half coward, have been playing a con game with reality, but the victim you have conned is yourself. When men reduce their virtues to the approximate, then evil acquires the force of an absolute. When loyalty to an unyielding purpose is dropped by the virtuous, it's picked up by scoundrels, and you get the indecent spectacle of a cringing, bargaining, traitorous good and a self-righteously uncompromising evil. As you surrendered to the mystics of muscle when they told you that ignorance consists of claiming knowledge, so now you surrender to them when they shriek that immorality consists of pronouncing moral judgment. When they yell that it is selfish to be certain that you are right, you hasten to assure them that you're certain of nothing. When they shout that it's immoral to stand on your convictions, you assure them that you have no convictions whatever. When the thugs of Europe's people's states snarl that you are guilty of intolerance because you don't treat your desire to live and their desire to kill you as a difference of opinion, you cringe and hasten to assure them that you are not intolerant of any horror. When some barefoot bum in some pest hole of Asia yells at you, "How dare you be rich?" you apologize and beg him to be patient and promise him you'll give it all away. You have reached the blind alley of the treason you committed when you agreed that you had no right to exist. Once you believed it was only a compromise. You conceded it was evil to live for yourself, but moral to live for the sake of your children. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your children, but moral to live for your community. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your community, but moral to live for your country. Now, you are letting this greatest of countries be devoured by any scum from any corner of the earth, while you concede that it is selfish to live for your country, and that your moral duty is to live for the globe. A man who has no right to life has no right to values and will not keep them. At the end of your road of successive betrayals, stripped of weapons, of certainty, of honor, you commit your final act of treason and sign your petition of intellectual bankruptcy, while the muscle mystics of the people's states proclaim that they are the champions of reason and science. You agree, and hasten to proclaim that faith is your cardinal principle, that reason is on the side of your destroyers, but yours is the side of faith. To the struggling remnants of rational honesty, in the twisted, bewildered minds of your children, you declare that you can offer no rational argument to support the ideas that created this country, that there is no rational justification for freedom, for property, for justice, for rights, that they rest on a mystical insight and can be accepted only on faith, that in reason and logic the enemy is right, but faith is superior to reason. You declare to your children that it is rational to loot, to torture, to enslave, to expropriate, to murder, but that they must resist the temptations of logic and stick to the discipline of remaining irrational. That skyscrapers, factories, radios, airplanes were the products of faith and mystic intuition, while famines, concentration camps, and firing squads are the products of a reasonable manner of existence. That the Industrial Revolution was the revolt of the men of faith against that era of reason and logic, which is known as the Middle Ages. Simultaneously, in the same breath, to the same child, you declare that the looters who rule the people's states will surpass this country in material production, since they are the representatives of science, but that it's evil to be concerned with physical wealth, and that one must renounce material prosperity. You declare that the looters' ideals are noble, but they do not mean them, while you do. that your purpose in fighting the looters is only to accomplish their aims, which they cannot accomplish, but you can, and that the way to fight them is to beat them to it and give one's wealth away. Then you wonder why your children join the people's thugs or become half-crazed delinquents. You wonder why the looters' conquests keep creeping closer to your doors. And you blame it on human stupidity, declaring that the masses are impervious to reason. You blank out the open public spectacle of the looters' fight against the mind, and the fact that their bloodiest horrors are unleashed to punish the crime of thinking. You blank out the fact that most mystics of muscle started out as mystics of spirit, that they keep switching from one to the other, that the men you call materialists and spiritualists are only two halves of the same dissected human, forever seeking completion, but seeking it by swinging from the destruction of the flesh to the destruction of the soul and vice versa, that they keep running from your colleges to the slave pens of Europe to an open collapse into the mystic muck of India, seeking any refuge against reality, any form of escape from the mind. You blank it out and cling to your hypocrisy of faith in order to blank out the knowledge that the looters have a stranglehold upon you, which consists of your moral code, that the looters are the final and consistent practitioners of the morality you're half obeying, half evading, that they practice it the only way it can be practiced, by turning the earth into a sacrificial furnace, that your morality forbids you to oppose them in the only way they can be opposed, by refusing to become a sacrificial animal and proudly asserting your right to exist, that in order to fight them to the finish and with full rectitude, it is your morality that you have to reject. You blank it out, because your self-esteem is tied to that mystic unselfishness which you've never possessed or practiced, but spent so many years pretending to possess, that the thought of denouncing it fills you with terror. No value is higher than self-esteem, but you've invested it in counterfeit securities, and now your morality has caught you in a trap where you are forced to protect your self-esteem by fighting for the creed of self-destruction. The grim joke is on you. That need of self-esteem, which you're unable to explain or to define, belongs to my morality, not yours. It's the objective token of my code. It is my proof within your own soul. By a feeling he has not learned to identify, but has derived from his first awareness of existence, from his discovery that he has to make choices, man knows that his desperate need of self-esteem is a matter of life or death. As a being of volitional consciousness, he knows that he must know his own value in order to maintain his own life. He knows that he has to be right. To be wrong in action means danger to his life. To be wrong in person, to be evil, means to be unfit for existence. Every act of man's life has to be willed. The mere act of obtaining or eating his food implies that the person he preserves is worthy of being preserved. Every pleasure he seeks to enjoy implies that the person who seeks it is worthy of finding enjoyment. He has no choice about his need of self-esteem. His only choice is the standard by which to gauge it. And he makes his fatal error when he switches this gauge, protecting his life, into the service of his own destruction, when he chooses a standard contradicting existence and sets his self-esteem against reality. Every form of causeless self-doubt, every feeling of inferiority and secret unworthiness, is in fact man's hidden dread of his inability to deal with existence. But the greater his terror, the more fiercely he clings to the murderous doctrines that choke him. No man can survive the moment of pronouncing himself irredeemably evil, should he do it. His next moment is insanity or suicide. To escape it, if he's chosen an irrational standard, he will fake, evade, blank out. He will cheat himself of reality, of existence, of happiness, of mind. And he will ultimately cheat himself of self-esteem by struggling to preserve its illusion, rather than to risk discovering its lack. To fear to face an issue is to believe that the worst is true. It is not any crime you have ever committed that infects your soul with permanent guilt. It is none of your failures, errors, or flaws, but the blank out by which you attempt to evade them. It is not any sort of original sin or unknown prenatal deficiency, but the knowledge and fact of your basic default, of suspending your mind, of refusing to think. Fear and guilt are your chronic emotions. They are real, and you do deserve them. but they don't come from the superficial reasons you invent to disguise their cause. Not from your selfishness, weakness, or ignorance, but from a real and basic threat to your existence, fear, because you have abandoned your weapon of survival, guilt, because you know you have done it volitionally. The self you have betrayed is your mind. Self-esteem is reliance on one's power to think. The ego you seek, that essential you which you cannot express or define, is not your emotions or inarticulate dreams, but your intellect, that judge of your supreme tribunal whom you've impeached in order to drift at the mercy of any stray shyster you describe as your feeling. Then you drag yourself through a self-made night in a desperate quest for a nameless fire, moved by some fading vision of a dawn you had seen and lost. Observe the persistence in mankind's mythologies of the legend about a paradise that man had once possessed. The city of Atlantis, or the Garden of Eden, or some kingdom of perfection, always behind us. The root of that legend exists not in the past of the race, but in the past of every man. You still retain a sense, not as firm as a memory, but diffused, like the pain of hopeless longing, that somewhere, in the starting years of your childhood, before you had learned to submit, to absorb the terror of unreason and to doubt the value of your mind, you had known a radiant state of existence. You had known the independence of a rational consciousness facing an open universe. That is the paradise which you have lost, which you seek, which is yours for the taking. Some of you will never know who is John Galt, but those of you who have known a single moment of love for existence and of pride in being its worthy lover, a moment of looking at this earth and letting your glance be its sanction, have known the state of being a man, and I'm the only man who knew that that state is not to be betrayed. I'm the man who knew what made it possible and who chose consistently to practice and to be what you had practiced and been in that one moment. That choice is yours to make. That choice, the dedication to one's highest potential, is made by accepting the fact that the noblest act you have ever performed is the act of your mind in the process of grasping that 2 and 2 make 4. Whoever you are, you who are alone with my words in this moment, with nothing but your honesty to help you understand, the choice is still open to be a human being, but the price is to start from scratch, to stand naked in the face of reality and reversing a costly historical error to declare, I am, therefore I'll think. Admit the irrevocable fact that your life depends upon your mind. Admit that the whole of your struggle, your doubts, your fakes, your evasions, was a desperate quest for escape from the responsibility of a volitional consciousness, a quest for automatic knowledge, for instinctive action, for intuitive certainty. And while you called it a longing for the state of an angel, what you were seeking was the state of an animal. Accept as your moral ideal the task of becoming a man. Do not say that you're afraid to trust your mind because you know so little. Are you safer in surrendering to mystics and discarding the little that you know? Live and act within the limit of your knowledge, and keep expanding it to the limit of your life. Redeem your mind from the hock-shops of authority. Accept the fact that you are not omniscient, but playing a zombie will not give you omniscience. That your mind is fallible, but becoming mindless will not make you infallible. That an error made on your own is safer than 10 truths accepted on faith, because the first leaves you the means to correct it, but the second destroys your capacity to distinguish truth from error. In place of your dream of an omniscient automaton, accept the fact that any knowledge man acquires is acquired by his own will and effort, and that that is his distinction in the universe. That is his nature, his morality, his glory. Discard that unlimited license to evil which consists of claiming that man is imperfect. By what standard do you damn him when you claim it? Accept the fact that in the realm of morality nothing less than perfection will do, but perfection is not to be gauged by mystic commandments to practice the impossible, and your moral stature is not to be gauged by matters not open to your choice. Man has a single basic choice, to think or not.